optimal minimalism.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multimineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, my fine feathered friends. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to another episode of The Tim Ferriss Show, where it is my job each episode to deconstruct world-class performers and tease out the routines, habits, daily rituals, breakfasts, favorite books, whatever it might be that you can emulate, test in your own life. This episode is a role reversal and a very hilarious one at that. Jamie Foxx is back on the show. This is a round 2 where he interviewed me for his radio show and we simultaneously recorded for the podcast. It was great fun. We recorded in his studio at his home in Los Angeles. For those of you who didn't hear the first appearance of Jamie on the podcast, it was voted 2015 Podcast of the Year last year with Product Hunt and others. The title was Jamie Foxx on Workout Routines, Success Habits, and Untold Hollywood Stories. You can check that out at 4hourworkweek.com/Jamie. And for those interested, the second place runner-up for Podcast of the Year was also from The Tim Ferriss Show, and that was Naval Ravikant. If you haven't heard of him, you got to learn all about him. And that is 4hourworkweek.com/Naval, N-A-V-A-L. Few things about this episode. So it's cut up into segments because we were taking commercial breaks for the radio show. There were a number of songs that Jamie comments on or refers to indirectly that I couldn't play in this podcast due to copyright reasons. They are from Seu Malemolência, and one of the hottest voices and faces ever, that is Brazilian Portuguese, Baby Metal, Karate, Federico Aubele, Esta Noche, and then Seven Dust, Splinter. All of these will be linked to in the show notes, so just go to 4hourworkweek.com/podcast for all the show notes on this episode and every other episode. And there are going to be a couple of stories in here for very long-term listeners that you've probably heard some variation of before because people ask me about some of my backstory, etc. There are definitely things you have not heard before, including Jamie's exploration of past lives, and it goes in many different directions, but
I think you'll enjoy it, and at the very least, listen to the first few minutes, because Jamie is the consummate performer, which is, of course, what you would expect from someone who is an Academy Award-winning actor, Grammy Award-winning musician, and a famous stand-up and improv comedian. He has all the tools in the toolkit. And you can say hi to Jamie on Twitter, at IamJamieFox, two X's. And without further ado, please enjoy this raucous romp through the mind of Jamie Foxx and yours truly.
If I told you that Oprah Winfrey is now a white man, if I told you that Oprah Winfrey has now become Caucasian, what would you say? I got a chance to meet this man. This man literally changed my life. My young friend Ricardo, who speaks seven languages, he's a heartthrob. He explained to me about who this guy was. Says, you need to do this guy's podcast. And I was like, really? Because I'm ancient when it came to the internet, when it came to these things, the social media. I was so far behind. And Ricardo would always say, you got to shake off the dust. You know, it's like my parents when they were trying to figure out a microwave. And he brought this guy into my house. And we did this incredible interview. And literally, it was like I had a record out when I left. It was like I had a movie out when I left. I was getting stopped by people of all walks of life and said, Jamie, I don't necessarily like your shit, but what you did on this man's show moved me. Joe Rogan, who I'm known from the comedy world, Ricardo sends me a clip of Joe Rogan talking about this man. I'm talking about now 70 million downloads. Am I right? 70 million. Some of you guys don't even have 65 likes. And you're constantly, constantly, constantly posting. You need to get it together. Maybe you need his 4-hour plan. I'm talking about none other. The Oprah Winfrey of the internet. Ladies and gentlemen, turn the music up. Tim Ferriss is in the building. Tim, how you doing, baby?
I'm doing fantastic. So thanks again for having me.
Hey, man.
I love this studio. It's good.
Hey, listen, man.
Good vibes in this studio.
It's great vibes, man. Listen, all I can say is that I cannot say enough of who you are. I was in New York. Lawyers, doctors, all walks of people came up to me and said, yo, Jamie, the Tim Ferriss interview, like, took me over the moon. And I was like, I was, you know, obviously Ricardo had told me who you were and all the research, cannot put into words how you impact the world. Where do you come from? what are you doing since 1977? You were born in 87.
I was born in 77.
Okay.
I had time to pick up.
I was trying to
break into Electric Boogaloo. Little cardboard off Long Island.
Now the song we just played is one of Tim's top five songs. What was the name of that song?
That is Malemolência by a singer named Seu from Brazil.
Wow. And you know what? You made the foxhole work too, because I asked him for his five songs and he didn't give me no iTunes shit. He said, get in those crates. And luckily we have a Cuban who's putting things together. And before Trump gets in office, you know, we got a few. Anyway, we got a few minutes. We'll talk about all that later on. We're here with Tim Ferriss. Tim, where do you come from, man? What gives you the mindset? Now, I've met you, you've interviewed me, but like now people want to know who you are. Like, where do you come from?
I was born and raised on Long Island.
Wow.
Rat tail and all.
Long Island.
Strong Island.
Strong Island.
Out at the end. And yeah. Mom was a physical therapist, dad a real estate broker. Local real estate broker, and my parents were very good at encouraging me and my younger brother, that's the family, to explore. And they always had, they didn't have much budget for anything other than books. So if we latched onto something, they would take us to, say, the remainder table at the bookstore and find these discounted books.
Wow.
And
remainder table.
Yeah. And wow. That is where I think a lot of the experimentation started, mostly because I was very hyperactive as a kid, but I was a runt. I was born premature. And so my mom got some good word from the other the other ladies, the other moms, that kid wrestling was a good place to exhaust your kid.
So she threw
me into wrestling. And I had no endurance because of some lung issues and other issues. So I started getting very good in high school at cutting weight. And that's where I started really studying the human body, and this obsession with self-experimentation took off.
Why self-experimentation? What makes you think that, though? I mean, because here's what I say all the time. It's like people have gifts. You know, everybody's given a gift. But what would make you think self-experimentation, and how would that manifest to what it is right now? Or did you foresee that?
Well, I think that one of the catalysts was a weakness that turned into a strength. So for cutting weight, I always sweat very easily, which meant that I could get dehydrated very easily. Now, that was a liability and a problem in so many other sports. But in wrestling, if I'm trying to cut down to a lower weight class, it was a huge advantage. I could lose water weight very quickly.
Wow.
And so I started thinking, well, if that's the case, that this weakness can be turned into a strength, where else can I find Achilles heels that I can turn into advantages?
Wow.
And it just led me to be a bit more analytical than I suppose some of the other kids who were normal and they could compete in the normal way. I just couldn't do that.
Right.
And I also had a very influential coach, wrestling coach, Mr. Buxton, who was, I think, a rarity in today's climate, at least. He was a hard ass who, like, cared enough to really beat your ass.
Yeah, that's the old school, Tim. We don't have that no more. You can't touch the kids no more. Man, my father was a teacher for 20 years. Can't touch the kids. He said, I wouldn't be able to govern. So he whooped your ass, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just remember one practice we had these drills. I think they're called blood circles or some horrible name.
Oh, man.
And I was like, Mr. Buxton, I don't think I can do it. And he's not only a successful coach. I mean, he was a tri-varsity athlete in college and exceptional athlete and coach, but he was also very good at teaching. He was a teacher, English teacher, I believe, and an incredible fundraiser for the school. So he was multi-talented. Now he's the dean of Culver Academy, Military Academy in Indiana. Wow. But sense. I remember at one point I was like, Mr. Buxton, I can't do it anymore. I'm going to puke. And he's like, that's what the bucket over there is for.
Wow.
So go over there and puke and then come back and continue the drilling.
Wow.
And what was great about that environment, although I didn't realize it at the time, is that he pushed all of us past the point that we felt was our limit.
Right.
And if you look at the kids who are in that wrestling team, like my wrestling partner, a guy named Charles Best, who was a year ahead of me, always beat me by 1 point in wrestle-offs for the varsity spot.
Where's Charles now?
So Charles is the CEO and founder of a nonprofit called Donors Choose, which is a huge educational nonprofit that has people like Oprah Winfrey and Stephen Colbert and all these supporters. Huge, massive success that's changing the world. And he also credits a lot of his success back to Mr. Buxton.
Back to the coach. Steel, sharp and steel. It's Jamie Foxx, Foxhole Radio. You know how we get down. Series 96. We are with the Oprah Winfrey of the internet. We're with the Oprah. His podcast is number one. He's breaking it down on how he learned what self-experimentation was. He tells us that his coach, which I still credit my coach, Coach Heisek, my seventh grade coach, who gave me licks if my grades was wrong, gave me licks if I got caught outside. You know, he made sure he was doing. He's given us building blocks. But talk about this. When you say there was a problem, can you speak on what it was? You had a lung situation?
Yeah, I had. So my lung collapsed when I was born. Wow. And I think I had five total blood transfusions. So I was in the ICU as a young kid. And so I still have scars on the left side of my chest. Wow. And then on my wrist here, it looks kind of like a cigarette burn. It's not a cigarette burn.
I was about to say.
That's from it being intubated. And so even to this day, I'm very, very sensitive to heat and have a lot of issues with even heat stroke in a few occasions where I've had to be hospitalized. Wow. And my brain just doesn't function. It turns off. It has a set point where these things called heat shock proteins and whatnot get triggered at a relatively low temperature compared to other folks.
Right.
So
you got to stay cool.
I have to stay cool.
Yeah.
Gotta stay cool. Yeah.
It almost sounds like a superhero.
It's like,
do you remember Unbreakable?
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost like, wow, you take these things. It's like he's a superhero. He's able to give you a 4-hour plan, but don't let him be in the sun.
Definitely weak in the sun. I mean, you can see I'm not. I look like the underbelly of, I don't know, a manatee or something.
It's all right, man. I got some spray tan in there. You know, a couple of white girls came through.
Well, I think what I've, if you know, so I was a comic book nerd growing up, so I collected comics.
And who's your favorite comic?
Wolverine.
Wow.
Because Wolverine was human. I mean, he was human.
Yeah, speak on it, brother.
Wolverine and the Punisher. So I was, in other words, I was fans of the human comic book heroes who had found strengths or augmented strengths. So like Superman, it's like, hey, you were born that way.
Yeah.
Batman, like, he had to build.
Yeah, yeah,
all the tools around him. Yeah, so that appealed to me as kind of the tinkerer. Right. And, you know, even to this day, I trace it all back to these physical problems that I had as a kid. Right. And for instance, this is about, I want to say five or 10 years ago, I did an experiment at Stanford University. I found out that they were doing research on heat tolerance for soldiers. And I was like, wow. Oh, this is a chance for me to gather data on myself and figure out why my brain turns off. And so the experiment was terrible. What they had us do is I'd have to put an esophageal probe down my nose. So this is a piece of plastic that's about 2 feet long. You put it through your nostril, down your throat to your heart level. To measure your core body temperature, and then you tape it so it doesn't get lost. Wow. And then you take another one and you stick it up the other end.
Because what does that mean?
You stick it up your ass. Up to your heart that direction.
Wow.
So because the military wants that data.
Yeah.
And then you put on a full military outfit, like full military gear, weighted backpack, helmet, everything. You go into 100 and I think it was 4 degree sauna and march on an incline treadmill to exhaustion until you've basically have heat stroke.
So you have something up your ass and up your nose and
down your
nose.
Throat.
This is going all out. No wonder you know your shit to be able to, literally.
Oh yeah.
And you did this.
I did. And what they were testing was a glove that you stuck your hand into this glove and it would create a vacuum around your wrist and then circulate cold water around a metal cylinder that you grabbed. And the theory was you could use that to rapidly cool your body temperature. So they wanted to develop it for soldiers.
Right.
And it was being tested at the time by some very, very good boxers, some very, very good athletes. So that was all it took for me to volunteer to do it. I only did about 4 sessions. I was like, after the 4th session, I was like,
4 times of it going
like,
up.
All right. Yeah, I got. Think I've had enough of this.
Yeah. Did you smoke a cigarette after? Ladies and gentlemen, it's Jamie Foxx, Fox Hope Radio. It's Sirius XM 96. We're going to take a break and we're coming right back and find out how he went from that to being the top person on the internet. This is another song that he loves. Another one bites the dust. Tim Ferriss, we'll be back in a moment. Sirius XM 96. Self-experimentation leading up to being one of the most sought afters, the number one podcast in the world. I'm here with none other than the incredible, the remarkable superhero Tim Ferriss in the building. How you doing, man?
Better and better.
Better and better. So take me through it. Take me through going through the experiments, finding out what you want to do up until 4-hour work week.
Sure. So the trajectory was.
But get me to that. But just don't go straight to that.
I'll get you there.
You know, where'd you find this niche?
Well, I think there were a couple of things. So I had an opportunity my sophomore year in high school to go abroad for the first time.
Yeah.
There was an exchange program that was available to me. And I'd never spent really any time outside the United States.
Right.
You know, up Niagara Falls, maybe crossed over into Canada. But went to Japan for a year and lived with Japanese families, went to a Japanese school. I was the only white kid, only American kid at a school of 5,000 Japanese kids.
Wow.
School uniforms and everything. So I was completely immersed in that culture for a year, and what it showed me was how arbitrary a lot of our rules are.
Really?
Meaning, like, we drive on one side of the street, they drive on the other.
Mm-hmm.
We We take showers a certain way. They share baths, but you have to take a shower before you get in the bath, and the whole family uses the same bath water.
Is that some kind of spiritual thing, or what is
it? It's just a Japanese cultural tradition, ofuro. They have these deep soaking baths, and they go in order of seniority. So it's like grandma gets to go in first, then dad, then mom, then the siblings from oldest to youngest. So it's like if you're the youngest kid, you get the dregs.
Yeah, I mean, you get grandma's.
You got grandma's pubes like floating around. It's a trip. So
come on, granny.
And that's not an exaggeration. I was like, oh god, what is this?
So you get in after the whole family.
So I mean, I would get in actually before the youngest brother because I was older than he was.
Okay,
but the point being that it showed me that our rules were very arbitrary. A lot of our rules are just kind of socially reinforced, and that there's room to improvise. You can negotiate those things.
Right.
You can experiment. You can be different. You can march to your own drummer.
Right.
And when I came back, I finished high school and ended up going to college in New Jersey. I went to Princeton undergraduate and first studied neuroscience and then transferred to East Asian studies, where I focused on Japanese, Chinese, and Korean. I was mostly focused on the languages and language acquisition.
And why that? Why do you feel it was that? What is it, the certain disciplines that they have, or when you went over there, you felt something that made you change? Like, so sort of like when I went to Africa, like there was this thing that I felt like it was from. I said, wow, I feel this amazing thing in Mozambique, and I stood, you know, in the ocean, and I was like, oh, I feel this thing. Is that the same?
You know, you're the first person who's kind of dug into this. Yes, I did feel something.
Right.
And when I was there, and you know, I don't want to go as far to say like, oh my God, maybe in a past life, this, that, or the other thing. But for us on our show,
yeah. Please do that because we don't want to skim. So if you really felt that,
oh, I'll jump right into it. I did. And to the extent that, you know, some of my closest friends, when I got into judo and I was training in different martial arts there and so on, they would say, oi, Timu, omae Nihonjin da yo. They would insist. They're like, you're Japanese.
Wow.
You're not American. You're Japanese. And I don't get it because that's weird.
Wow.
And so they would always, I mean, there's an expression which is just like strange foreigner, henna gaijin. And then just be like, oh, omae henna gaijin da yo. Then they would just go on and on.
Help me say that. What'd you say?
So strange, well, okay.
Now, how do I say it?
So if you want to say strange foreigner, it's
henna
gaijin.
Gaijin.
Yeah, henna gaijin.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to, like, if you're hanging out with some Japanese people and like, and some non-Japanese did something funny, you could just wait until they walked off and look at them and just go, henna gaijin.
Henna gaijin. Or if I'm just hanging out with some rappers and I don't like their song, I just
henna gaijin.
but here's the thing, like, but speak on that spiritual thing, because I think that is really real.
Yeah.
And we've talked, you know, we were at a party, you expressed something about, you know, coyotes and things like that.
Yeah.
But speak on that you felt something.
So in Japan, I felt like in a lot of ways I was returning home to a place I had never been, which is an odd feeling to have. But the simplicity, the striving for elegance, and the way they use negative space, for instance, just the way that you'll have certain rooms in the house that are extremely uncluttered, that are used for... they have altars, they have tatami rooms, and it just struck a chord with me, and I felt like I was returning to something, but of course, I had never been there previously. And quite frankly, a lot of the strict rules that they socially enforce, so you have, for instance, in the judo club, you have, and this can go wrong, right? I'm not saying all of it's good, but
no.
you have senpai, which are like the upperclassmen, and then you have kohai, which are like the lowerclassmen.
Yeah.
And it's very hierarchical. It's
right.
Like you do what the senpai tell you to do.
Really?
But it was what I really enjoyed about it, and what I had not really had, because I was the oldest sibling in my family, was like, they'll beat your ass, but no one else is allowed to beat your ass. You know what I mean?
So it was a very kind of
older brother type of relationship, but I was always the oldest, so I hadn't ever experienced that. And I found just like tremendous comfort in that in a large extent. And it was an easy to understand culture also. I think in the US right now, people are prone not to say what they mean. And I'll come back to that in a second.
Okay.
And there's so much political correctness and...
Wow, I want to get into that.
Yeah.
As a comedian.
And everybody's concerned with upsetting everyone else's feelings. Whereas in Japan, once you get past what they call tatemae. So tatemae is like what you put forward to other people.
Right.
And then honne is what you really feel.
Right.
And only if you speak Japanese, people are like, oh my God, Japanese people, they never say what they mean. I'm like, that's bullshit. You just don't speak Japanese. Like, right. If you speak the language, they'll let you in.
They're constantly saying
and then,
the shoes you got on.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I just found it a very refreshing culture,
right.
in the sense that there were rules that had worked for them for thousands of years, and not all positive things came from them, but
right.
it did feel oddly familiar to me.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Because you say that quite frankly, or maybe it could have been a past life. We did a great radio interview with Quentin Tarantino on here, and we talked about how he used the N-word, how mm-hmm. he used the word. And I wanted to get him on because, you know, a lot of black folks, you know, especially dealing with all the things with the Oscars, all these different things about, you know, that word and why Quentin Tarantino. And he said, before we got on the radio, and he also said on the radio, I felt that in my past life, I was actually a black man. And when he said that, it was no hokiness. It was actually, you know, you believe it because he spoke with conviction. So talk about it. Do you think that we do live past lives, or is it selective?
I don't rule it out. I mean, I don't have any evidence for it.
Right.
But my experience in Japan was quirky enough and just... Right. felt deep and real enough that there seems to be more to the story.
Right.
Even to the extent, and of course there are alternate ways to explain this, but I had trouble learning Spanish. Then I went to Japan and I picked up Japanese like a snap of the fingers.
Wow.
And there were challenges, but even the characters and so on came to me very naturally. And I think that was part of visual memory. But it was a transformative experience. So right. that year abroad sort of informed and changed the trajectory of my life.
Wow.
Completely.
Wow.
And the way that I related to American culture and to wow. thinking of myself and to thinking of what was, you know, quote unquote real or realistic. I was right. like, well, here's a culture that works just fine.
Yeah.
And it's totally different. Like right. the rules of engagement, the rules of interrelating wow. are totally different.
Wow.
So what's to prevent me from taking those and bringing them back to the US or just trying to find option C, right? Mm.
Right.
And so I think that is also something that opened my eyes to just asking what if questions. Like, well, what if I did this that no one else is doing?
Right.
What's the worst thing that could happen? What's the downside? Let me try it and then test.
Right. It's Jamie Foxx, Foxhole Radio. We're getting deep right now. It's Foxhole Radio, Series 96. If you don't know, you better know. Tim Ferriss right now. Go to his podcast right now. He is the number one podcast in the world. 70 billion downloads. 70 billion. We're closing.
I'm working on billion.
70 million. But you know what I'm saying. We on our way there. He is considered the Oprah Winfrey of audio podcast. We're going to get to that. Let me keep on with this. You said something about the political incorrectness. You said something about what are we going through right now in the world? Because I do feel that there's a fine line. Me as a comedian, I've always, you know, I've been put on this earth for that. I've been put on this earth to look at what is funny no matter what. Whether it's Christian, whether it's Muslim, whether it's fat, skinny, tall, short, that is my license. But right now in America, we're going through something that is incredibly weird, especially when I talk to Jay Leno. I talked to Rock, Chris Rock, who had a very, very tough time landing at the Oscars, which was tough. I thought it was the toughest job in the world for him to have to do because we want to respect Jada Pinkett Smith in that sense. But at the same time, we have to do our jokes because it is. But and it put him in this weird thing. What do you think we should do? Since you the Oprah Winfrey, we coming to you right now. Tim, put us in the right light. Like, what do we need to be?
I think we should worry about helping people and not placating right. people.
Wow. Wow.
I think we should concern ourselves with speaking truth and not glad-handing.
Wow.
And that's easier said than done, of course, but I really feel, and I've said this to friends of mine in close conversation where I live in Silicon Valley before, that I feel like comedians are the only people right now who can speak truth.
Right. Right.
And it's just like the court jester back in the day. It was like the court jester could speak truth to the king. Anyone else to have their head lopped off.
Yeah.
And that person had license. And my feeling is hopefully we can expand that, and we need to expand that, because I've noticed among some of my most intelligent, most incisive, most influential friends, they've just opted out of the conversation because they're afraid of getting chased by the lynch mob, so to speak, for saying anything that is truth. And that's a dangerous trend. That's a very dangerous trend. And I'll just mention one more thing, which is there's a book that a lot of people read in high school called Fahrenheit 451. And these firemen run around and they burn books. Wow. And if you ask anyone who's read the book but hasn't read it in like 20 years, what do you remember of how that came to be in the book? They'd say, oh, there's this totalitarian government. The truth is, it was the people. It was the people who decided that any dissenting opinions that would offend specific groups in society ought to be burned. So it was self-inflicted.
Wow.
And I think that's what we're doing right now, is we are slowly torching the First Amendment and free speech by basically just going on these witch hunts.
Right.
And I think it's the most dangerous thing in the U.S. right now.
Yeah, and here's the thing. And I think what's also dangerous, too, is sometimes the wrong people bring the message without mentioning any names, but sometimes it makes it hard when other people go so far and it ain't funny. You know what I'm saying? Like I always say like this, yeah, we could say whatever we want to say as long as you have it wrapped up in some sort of funny or something that gives us a little caveat of I care about you. Yeah, I'm going to talk about you. I did a joke about Bruce Jenner early on, but the reason that the joke was there is because in comedy, if we are all equal, then that means everybody gets equal jokes.
Right.
Like I can't do the black joke and then not do the white joke. There was a situation when I had to host this award show. And they went through and they looked at all of our jokes, and all the jokes that were for African-Americans, they were like, oh, man, that is hilarious. But then the ones that weren't for African-Americans, which was, you know, some of the white people who were talking, they had a hard time with it. And I was like, listen, I said, we have to do it all across the board, straight, gay, black, white. We have to give everybody an opportunity to get in. And they were so nervous about me doing these jokes. But when we went out and did them, even the people that we were talking about came up and said, oh, man, we loved it, because it felt like they were part of the party. And it was sort of like, I said, you got to trust the comedian that, yeah, it's going to hurt a little bit. And I asked this, and I'll ask you this question. I'll ask you, when do you laugh at a joke your hardest? When?
When it's the most uncomfortable?
When it's not about you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, there we go.
When you laugh, oh, man, them Japanese do be doing that. Yeah, man, the Mexicans do be doing that. They say black people, hey, man, why are you going at us like that? It's just sort of, I want to take a break. I want to come back to that just to tie that up, because I really want to get your take on it, not my take on it, on how we can navigate now through a world where we've gone too politically correct, have we? And then how do we not go too far on the other side without putting something there that's in, you know, that makes sense, if it makes sense. We're here with Tim Ferriss. It's Fox So Serious right here. You better tune in right now and get your life right, because he's going to come in after this and tell you how to get your life together in 4 hours. Serious 96. Jay Fox, Fox O. We'll be right back. Tim. What is this? What is this song?
This is Baby Metal Karate.
Baby Metal Karate, baby. That's what's going to be in the playlist. That's Tim Ferriss. It's Fox O Radio Series 96. We are getting nourished right now. We're not just having a radio show. We're getting nourished with our minds. We were just talking before we went to break. We were talking about political correctness. Has it become too much? And you were talking about Daniel Tosh. I was
because I think that he is. If you look at his headshot, like this is a guy who you wouldn't expect to step out and bring some of the comedy that he does. And I recall at one point before he was, I think it was before Tosh but when he was doing stand-up, and what I appreciated was how uncomfortable he made everyone.
Yeah.
And I just remember this one bit, and there will be a point to this, but you know, he opened it up with, I wonder if
people taste like their ethnic cuisine, and I'm gonna massacre the bit. And he's like,
no, that's hilarious.
But he's like, and like black people, like, do they taste like fried chicken?
Hilarious.
And then everyone's like, oh, I don't know if I should laugh. And he's like, no, I'll get you. Don't worry. And he's like, Chinese people, kung pao chicken. And then everybody starts loosening up, and they're laughing. Yeah. The audience is probably 50% white. And then he's like, and white people? He's like, no, we don't eat white people. And so they didn't get the out. They didn't get the out.
Yeah.
So everyone's like, oh my god, was it okay to laugh? Was it not okay to laugh?
Yeah.
And I think it was Mae West who said, you know, those who are offended easily should be offended more often.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
And I think that in the US right now, we were just talking on break about how the internet, I think, it's a great tool, but it's like a knife. It cuts both ways.
Yeah.
And it can be used for harm or it can be used for good. And when every genius but every idiot has a voice,
are you a genius or an idiot?
Yeah.
It's the new t-shirt.
And everyone has a voice,
right.
But I think in that environment, what we've seen is that you can sacrifice, unfortunately, some people who could really contribute to society if they slip up and say one stupid thing, which we all say, but they'll get lynched, not by their peers necessarily, but people who aren't in a position and shouldn't be in a position to judge them. And so what I would say is that we have a term, social justice warrior, that's used for people who are just on the internet constantly saying, you can't say that.
Yeah.
You know, like we're talking about going to like college campuses and talking about whales. They're like, you're whale shaming.
Oh, yeah, man. I'm doing a college thing and I said something about whales. You're whale shaming. We couldn't do a joke on one of the things about sharks because some singer said she's doing the shark campaign to save the sharks, and they shut us down. We couldn't tell shark jokes.
That's unbelievable.
So
what
do we do?
One of the ways we could stem this tide is because I feel like there are a lot of people who can contribute to society, and we're all flawed human beings. We're all going to make mistakes. We're all going to say stupid things. That shouldn't remove your ability to contribute to society, right?
Right.
Let's say somebody does say something racist or sexist or fill in the blank, if they're doing incredibly valuable work like that, they shouldn't have to resign from their job necessarily for that. Now, I mean, of course, it's a question of degree, but what I would say is one of the ways I think we need to stem the tide is by using language, because that's the weapon that's being used to sort of mute freedom of speech. In other words, if someone says fill in the blank ist, they can shut you down. They can end your comedy show.
Right.
Well, right now we don't have a term to apply to those people who cry wolf too often and do unmitigated damage. So what if instead of social justice warrior, which sounds actually net positive, there was a term, the one that I thought of was bigoteer. So bigoteer is someone who tries to be a profiteer by calling other people bigots.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, those people will have a consequence for crying wolf and falsely accusing people loosely.
Right.
So I think that language is one of the key pieces in this arsenal, because the problem itself is a problem of language. So I'm curious to see where it'll go. And also, I would just implore people, comedians and other people who are in a position where perhaps they're, say, self-employed, so they don't have or they don't perceive as many risks as someone who's in like a tight corporate structure.
Right.
Speak your mind. And really recognize that the downside in most cases is being judged by people you shouldn't care about impressing in the first place.
Right.
So
there are people out there who just want to do that. Like, you know, I mean, sometimes people tell me about what Foxy, what they say about Justin. Nah, I don't really get into it, but yeah, he's racist. Nobody dates white girls, but then there's the Trayvon, but he's gay. And I said, man, you can't keep up with all of these things that people, and then if you say one thing, now I've always been this, even in the toughest situations where there's been situations of where either something's been said by black folks or something's been said by people that I care about, I've always been leery of someone saying something and you taking everything away from them.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was, I don't know if it was Don Imus. I remember who it was, but I believe myself and Howard Stern were on the same page. We were on the same. First of all, huge Howard Stern fan, like huge fan of his. Howard Stern has made his living his whole life. I mean, you know, Don Rickles 2.0, if you would. And we've said some of the wildest shit on our show and on his show, but I never thought that someone should be shut completely down. If we say something, we had to own up to Miley Cyrus. We did something that was, that she was 16. I didn't know who she was at the time. We did jokes that was, you know, we did that type of jokes. We were considered a Black Howard Stern. And once my daughter came to, Jay, why would you do that, Daddy, to Hannah Montana? And I was like, who is Hannah Montana? And we didn't know, but we did make a mistake. But what we did was we put ourselves on punishment. We went down for however many weeks. And then we came back. We made our apologies because, you know, it was, we offended people at that time. But what we asked was, don't let us close shop. Don't let us put away our comedy swords, because that's what we're here to do. And the interesting thing about jokes is, if half the room goes ooh and half the room laughs, that's usually a successful outing with jokes.
Definitely. And I think that for those people interested, you know, one of the biggest assets and resources for me over the last decade or so has been Stoic philosophy. And So Marcus Aurelius and Seneca, it's very old, but it's actually surprisingly easy to read. And the objective of Stoic philosophy is to give you basically an operating system for making better decisions in life without being reactive. And I think that we suffer from an illusion in the U.S., which is that comfort will bring happiness. Mm. And so we want to close our sphere of comfort, if that makes sense. Whereas we should want to expand our sphere of comfort by exposing ourselves to things that are uncomfortable, by exposing ourselves to opinions we dislike, exposing ourselves to, I mentioned I was fasting for the last few days, exposing myself to hunger so that I don't fear being hungry.
Wow.
So that if I'm in an airport and I'm like, oh, I haven't eaten in 6 hours, I should really have a Big Mac. No, you don't need to eat. You can you can go as long as you need to without eating.
Wow.
And developing a resilience and a strength in that. Right. And I think that if it's very important, and you see this in, for instance, where I live, Silicon Valley, a lot, because I've been involved with tech for a long time, but you have to make mistakes, and you have to make frequent mistakes in order to learn and innovate.
Wow.
And language is the underlying foundation of all of that. So like you said, if someone makes a mistake and you close up shop, that is the fastest way to end learning, innovation, pushing the envelope, and healing a lot of wounds. I mean, because you take these issues and you just shove them under the surface. You don't get rid of them by muting someone.
Right, exactly. Because I would always say, like, you're taking someone out of the equation who really can help you. Like, there are really racist people. There are really bigoted people out there. But the comedian and folks who are just, you know, like there was a situation and I'll talk about this because it's already out there. And she's a good friend of mine. But it was Amy Pascal. And there was this internet email thing. And people just went berserk. Oh my God, she's burning crosses. She got a white sheet in the back of a Mercedes. And I'm like, bro, look at the amount of movies that she's done that are African American. And Elijah's here. He could tell you, she was the only one doing African American film. You know, now you take something that was out of context. If they caught me in my house talking about other races, oh man, I wouldn't be able to go to Laos. I wouldn't be able to, I'd be talking about everybody. You know what I'm saying? But she was a great person when it came to doing African American movies. Now she's not there.
Yeah.
So now who you got? You know, so I was like, be careful on slinging that type of rhetoric around too much, because a lot of people that are out there are going to, like I said, you're going to make a mistake every once in a while. But like I said, you shouldn't throw them overboard. It's Fox Hole Radio, Sirius 96. We're here with Tim Ferriss. He's given us the tools when I tell you that Oprah Winfrey is now a white man and he's on the internet. His name is Tim Ferriss, 70 trillion downloads on his podcast. And I'm going to read what it says so people don't be like, oh, Jamie Foxx was saying Oprah Winfrey's dating a white man. No, what I'm saying is how Tim Ferriss became the Oprah of audio. How did you get into this? Let's get into it now. Tech world. You said the tech world. How does one get into that?
So I moved to the Bay Area. So I moved to the San Francisco area after college, and just in time for everything to implode. So I moved there in 99. Right. I was the second to lowest paid, aside from the secretary at this startup company. They made a mistake. They sent out an Excel spreadsheet, and one of the tabs was everybody's compensation. That was a big mistake. It made everybody upset. But in any case, that company imploded, and I found myself on the West Coast, and I was surrounded by tech. So I was in the middle of the switchboard. And so I decided to become involved, because I'd built some companies prior to that, in advising and investing in startups. And the way I looked at it, and I think this is a helpful way to look at a lot of things, is originally, as context, I had fantasized about going to Stanford Business School. There's a whole host of reasons, but I'd always felt like I was kind of intended to go to Stanford because it was a beautiful campus, the palm trees. Didn't go. And I was like, I need to go there for business school. Right. And I applied twice. I went through the process and I didn't go because it was too theoretical. And what I ended up deciding was, okay, I'm going to take the money that I would have had to pay for business school, and I'm going to put it into investing in startups. And that's going to be my MBA. So I'm going to, over 2 years, the same space of time, I'm going to invest small checks in these startups. And my assumption is I'm going to lose all the money. So I shouldn't use money that I can't afford to lose.
Right.
So over that period of time, I was looking at it as education. So it's like, what can I invest in where I will learn a lot? Right. What kind of startup can I invest in where I'll have the opportunity to interact with people who will average me up? Right. One piece of advice I was given when I was in my teens that I found probably the most useful of any was, you're the average of the five people you associate with most. So I was like, all right, how can I use these small bets to associate with higher and higher caliber of person? And I did that over the span of 2 years, and I didn't lose all the money. A couple of them worked. And so I've ended up investing in Twitter, Facebook, Uber, and many others. So that was the beginning of my relationship in tech and helping some of these startup founders in very particular ways. The audio came about in the podcast because I was burned out on books.
Really?
Yeah, I was totally burned out on books. I have this terrible habit of writing long books. So they're 400 to 700 pages long. And I was so...
This is your first book?
My first book was 420 pages. That was a four-hour work week. Right. That came out in 2007. Nobody expected it to do anything. It had an initial print run of 12,000 copies. Yeah. And it hit the New York Times list, largely thanks to early adoption by tech folks. Yeah. And it stayed there for more than four years unbroken. And nobody expected that to happen. So I remember my editor called me at the time, Heather, and I remember I got the call and she goes, I was exhausted because I was doing some like radio junket, satellite radio, things. You like sit there with like a pitcher of coffee and you do 30 radio interviews. And I just finished and I was so exhausted. And she called and she goes, "Hey there, Mr. New York Times bestselling author." And I was like, "What?" Wow. And she goes, "You hit the list." And I was like, "Heather, don't fuck with me. Not right now, please.
Right?
I can't do it." And she's like, "No, you hit the list." And it was just so unexpected and so surreal.
How'd you feel, man?
I leaned back against the wall. I was in a room by myself because everybody had left. It was like 6 p.m. on the East Coast, and just kind of slid down the wall and just like sat there. And I didn't know what to think.
The young kid with the collapsed lung.
Yeah, yeah. I was
the young kid whose body temperature gets heated up and
whose brain shuts down.
Brain shuts down, and all of a sudden you got a bestseller.
Yeah, it was. I was literally blank. Like I couldn't even conceive of it being real.
Right.
It's kind of like waking up from a dream, and you're like, oh no, that was just a dream.
Yeah.
So it took me a long time to even begin to conceive of how how that would affect my life. But it opened the door to writing more. So I'd never planned on being a writer. In fact, I decided after college I didn't want to write because I found it so painful.
Mm.
And so I think like many people maybe that you know, certainly people I know, they create things because they're scratching their own itch. Like they have to create it or it'll drive them crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so writing was like that for me.
Right.
And but the audio came about because I did three books and I just found myself burned out.
Right.
I felt like I'd been using the same part
of my
brain.
Talk about the three books.
So we have 4-Hour Work Week, which was really a collection of experiments.
For our listeners right now that's listening, Fox on Radio, Sirius 96, get into what 4-Hour Work Week is.
So the 4-Hour Work Week is a book that focuses on my studies of different entrepreneurs and case studies of my own, different experiments, looking at how you can 10x your hourly output.
Right.
And once you control that currency known as time, you can do all sorts of interesting things like travel. So it talks about low-cost travel. It talks about geo-arbitrage, where you might, say, outsource things to a different country and
very interesting ways to design ideal lifestyles. Right. So that was the first book. Right. And that's, it's been out for almost 10 years now, and it's still usually top 200 on Amazon. The next book, The 4-Hour Body, came back to my roots, the wrestling roots, right. basically, and it looked at physical performance.
Right.
So I did experiments in every possible way, whether it was maximal strength, sprinting, NFL combine training, holding my breath with David Blaine, sleep, wow. sex, you name it.
Sleep, sex, go back to that part.
So sleep, I studied people, friends of mine, who'd been able to get by for years on 2 to 2.5 hours of sleep a day by splitting their sleep up into something called polyphasic sleep, including Matt Mullenweg. So Ricardo knows of Matt Mullenweg, who runs a $1 billion company. Wow. And that was, sex, we looked at a bunch of different aspects. So for the men,
let's take a few minutes on that too. Let's talk about the sex. It's not that I'm really concerned about it. I just want to get your take on things right now.
Go ahead. We talked about things related to sort of male sexual health and performance, such right. as improving testosterone,
right.
improving sperm count,
right.
And so on. And then there were two chapters that probably did get a lot of attention, which were sure. on, they were on female.
All the guys peaked up like, how I need to do it now? What's going on?
Two chapters on everything related to female orgasm.
Wow.
And what was funny about that chapter is that I didn't realize it was right in the middle of the book. There are all these vagina diagrams.
Right.
And so the book got yanked out of Costco because there are all these moms who are like, oh,
just
look at this.
Open it up,
and it would just flip right open to all these vaginas, and their kids would just be like, what are these, mommy? And they're like, oh,
they're butterflies.
Yeah, it was just chaos. So the book got yanked out of Costco.
Oh man, that is it. Now our listeners are all over the planet, but what about a female orgasm? What's in this?
What's the key?
Yeah, what's the key?
Well, the key is the key is to start with. So about 50% of women in the U.S., last I checked, are inorgasmic. They've not experienced an orgasm. And that can have a lot of reasons, have a lot of explanations, whether it's religious upbringing, being the oldest sister is very common
really?
As a pattern. There are others, certainly. But what's very helpful, and people can look into this, is looking at something called orgasmic meditation, which is basically manual stimulation of the clitoris without any sex, meaning no penetration. So you separate the sexual act from the orgasm, and you effectively are practicing mindfulness and an attention to the sensation of being pleasured and stimulated for the woman. So there's no performance anxiety, in other words.
Wow.
And you just say, we're going to do this for 15 minutes, and you don't have to do anything. You just like focus on your breath and feeling.
Yeah.
And there's no sex. You don't have to do anything for me. You don't have to perform.
Wow.
And by removing all of those pressures and all those expectations with practice, and sometimes it's the first session, these women who have never experienced orgasms experience orgasms. Right. And then there's the technical piece, right? So if you're looking sort of directly at the clitoris, about 1 o'clock on that clitoris, top upper right quadrant, is where most women will be most sensitive.
Boy, Tim is, boy.
And
Tim is a pimp right now.
And light contact, which means like 4 kind of pages of paper deep. That's it. I think a lot of guys go after like they're starting a lawnmower. That's not not super effective.
Yeah, rubber knuckle.
Yeah, rubber knuckle.
Right. What are you trying to do, my guy?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So light.
It was a black girl.
So those are some of the things that are in that chapter.
That is amazing. That is amazing. And you know what? To be honest, that can help a lot of relationships.
It's directly saved marriages.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I got a letter from someone, a Hollywood director, pretty well-known guy, who was able to finally get pregnant with, well, he didn't get pregnant, but his wife got pregnant with a few of the things from the 4-Hour Body. Very simple stuff.
Man, it's Fox O Radio. Let Tim Ferriss get you pregnant. It's Sirius 96. We're going to take a break. We're coming right back. 1 o'clock, ladies. We out. Yes. Amp Radio, this is Jamie Foxx. We're back with Tim Ferriss. That's Seven Dust.
Seven Dust.
Now, all of you guys out there listening right now, trying to figure this out, I'm with Tim Ferriss. He is considered the Oprah of audio podcasts. You can get your life right. Now, and what's amazing, listening to that song right now, which is one of his top 5 songs, tell him who that is.
Well, that is Splinter
by Seven Dust, and I actually used that for a book trailer that I did for The 4-Hour Body.
Wow.
And people hear that, and they might not realize the characteristics of the lead singer. He is a black dude with long dreads from Atlanta.
See? Don't just homogenize. I mean, generalize.
And their acoustic double-wide album is incredible.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Amazing. We're going to get that. Yeah. We're going to get that. Listen, we talked about the books. We talked about 4-Hour Workday, 4-Hour Body. Talk about this, though. And I've always said this with Ricardo. You know, I'm late to the party when it comes to podcasts, when it comes to internet, when it comes to social media. I struggle with the whole idea of social media because it goes against sort of, against a little bit what I do. You know, like being an artist, I didn't know. It's weird to see the world change. It's weird to see the world change where, you know, I worked so much on, well, there's Mystique. And then my daughter, my oldest daughter, be like, Dad, you can stay hidden if you want to. They'll forget about you. I said, what you mean? You know, you drop the album, then you wait a couple of years, and she said, Dad, you better drop an album every 6 months or they forget about you. So Ricardo, you know, young, finger on the pulse of everything, huge fan of yours, comes to me and says, man, you have to meet this guy. He'll change your life. You did change my life. But let me ask you this. How did you master this? What is the ingredient, or is it just a blessing? What is this? How do you become 70 million downloads? That means that is interaction. That's not somebody saying these people are following me. This is going down.
And that's usually 2.5 hour interviews too. It's not like a 30-second video clip.
That's amazing.
It's a commitment. I think there are a few ingredients, and I'm sure there was a lot of luck and good timing involved, certainly. But there are a few things that I very deliberately keep in mind that I think have been helpful.
Right.
The first is, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, where you know you got a really strong joke when half the room laughs and half doesn't. Okay, so I never write. Let's just say, so my blog has, let's just call it 2.5-3 million readers, right?
Right.
Which at one point was around the same subscriber base as the Wall Street Journal, I think. But regardless, and I write long pieces. They're not short.
Right.
And when I write a piece, and this is true of the audio too, I never write a piece that I hope all 2.5 or 3 million people will like.
Right.
I try to write a post that 10% will love.
Mm.
And then I assume every few months I will hit everybody, right?
Right.
So it's like by the time I rotate through 6 or 10 articles, each person will get one that they are absolutely diehard,
right,
in love with, and they will share that. And on another level, when I write, I try to produce evergreen content, or when I'm recording audios. So when we were doing our recording, which was 3 feet from where we're sitting on the couch, I was trying to ask questions that would provoke stories and answers and lessons learned that people could use 10 years from now.
It's not
just a 3-minute TV interview, nothing wrong with that, but asking you about the latest celebrity news, which is going to be irrelevant in 6 months.
Right.
It was trying to search for the timeless and also trying to focus on really getting 10% to love something, even if the other 90% hate it. That's okay.
Right.
And I remember at some point, I don't recall who said it, but there was a quote I read that had a huge impact on me, which was, there's no sure path to success, but the sure path to failure is trying to please everyone.
Wow, Elijah, Ashley, did you just hear that? And I'm talking to Elijah and Ashley, who are incredible writers themselves as far as the movie, and they just sold some things. So they're getting this nourishment as well.
And there are also a few books that have had a very, very helpful impact on my thinking about this. One was a very short read. It's called The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like about it, get the old version, not the for the internet version.
Right.
Like the old version where they're looking at like imported beer and airlines, that's the one that I like. And it just talks about, you know, in simple terms, how to create new categories as opposed to trying to dominate an existing category.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
So it's easier and more effective to try to create a new category, which I often do through language.
Right.
So for instance, with the 4-Hour Work Week, I wrote the book that I couldn't find. It was basically the book that I wanted to find.
Mm.
And the options at the time, I went to the bookstore, I was searching for meaning. I had all these challenges with business, with entrepreneurship, and so on. And I could either choose a book that was how to give up money and why it's not important, how to reuse your toothpaste 17 times, or
how to build a Fortune 500 company with Jack Welch. And I wanted something in between. So I built that, or I wrote that, and ended up using this term that may have existed before, but I hadn't heard it, called lifestyle design. So lifestyle design, I did not trademark. I did not make any attempt to protect, because I wanted to become part of the common vocabulary. I wanted to become part of the vernacular, which it has. So now that's used by hundreds and thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people.
Lifestyle design.
And it's a category. Now, since I was first, I have that first mover advantage. Like, I am kind of forever, in a sense, the founding father of that category.
Right.
And the when I looked at podcasting, I asked myself two things. I asked myself, first and foremost, how can I do something that is different from what is currently out there?
Yeah.
And let's make a list of all the attributes. Like, let's call the 10, 20 people who are, say, organizers of events related to these things. What are their rules? And they lay it out. So they're like, okay, it needs to be this. You need to have musical segues. You need to have, it needs to be 20 minutes or less, or whatever they might be.
Right.
Whatever
their
rules are. And I would look at the most common rules, and then I would try the opposite. And
wow.
And what I realized was that if you focus also on highly tactical, actionable bits of information, not abstract, then it's a rarity right now. For whatever reason, things tend to get very, very abstract. So if I lay out, let's say, my common rapid-fire questions are designed very specifically to be actionable and therefore shareable, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. So if I ask a person, what is the book you've gifted the most to other people? What does the first 90 minutes of your morning look like? What is the purchase for $100 or less that has most impacted your life in the last 6 months? And I ask these questions. There are two aspects of it that make it very, very viral and very valuable. Well, number one is that people can emulate and test all of those things the next day. Secondly, they won't just share the information. They will try those things and then share the results that they get from that on social media or elsewhere.
Right.
And as a consequence of that, if I stopped writing completely, or if I stopped doing the podcast completely, my back catalog gets listened to so much that there would basically be no drop-off. So I could take the 3 years off, and I wouldn't actually fear being forgotten.
Right.
And there are counterexamples. So this is the other thing I always look for. I look for counterexamples of people who aren't doing what everyone else is doing. Like, this is the first one that comes to mind, but like Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
As far as I know, that guy's just, he's gone. He's a phantom unless he comes out, and then you're like, oh shit, he won another Oscar.
Yeah. It's sort of in between sometimes, because I do look at some people that use it a lot, and sometimes it may exhaust them a little. But I also look at the people who do stay refreshed, and I don't know this either, but I know Adele came out and just smashed, you know, and sold however many billions of records, while Beyonce, it is a, you know, it's an onslaught, you know, which is great as well. But it's, you know, I mean.
But you also end up in a kind of chicken or the egg conundrum, I think, with a lot of these celebrities, because one can wonder, did they sell so many records because they had a big social following, or did they get so many people as a social following because they weren't on social media and focused on their art first, right? So I am of the opinion, and this is speaking as a tech investor, like, I have, you know, I have a dog in this fight. Like, I have a lot to gain by people using social media. I think more artists are distracted from their most important work than are helped for their important work by social media.
Say that again, Tim! Let him know, Tim! Speak to the artist, Tim, right now. It's Fox O Radio, Sirius 96. I want people to really understand what you're saying, because I overheard an artist who didn't have to say this, that it was more about the machine than maybe the art. And my thing was, I think you're great at both, but if you forget about the art, that machine will fall on top of you.
Oh, the machine will churn you up.
Right?
Absolutely.
Talk to them, Tim, please. They need this right
now.
Well,
I think if I look at the writers that I most aspire to be like or emulate, if I look at the artists I most respect, they're very good at
shutting out distractions for a period of time and doing deep work.
Right.
And you need a certain degree of isolation, I think.
Yeah.
In many hour blocks of time to connect those uncommon dots or to create new dots altogether. And those who are distracted by social media are increasingly unable to create the conditions for their best work. And it's not hard to understand why, because, for instance, there's a book that I haven't seen, but a friend told me about, another writer. Yeah. And I think it's called Working on My Novel is the name of the book. Ooh. But it's a collection of tweets and Facebook posts from people who should have been working on their novel.
Wow. Like
all these writers who said they're on writing deadline, but writers will do anything to avoid writing. So you give them something easy to do, like post on Twitter, take pictures of their food and put it on Instagram.
Oh, Lord.
They're
Jesus.
Not going to write.
And Lord. You know what? This is giving. I'm not. First of all, let me say this. I know a lot of entertainers, and I know we're actually simulcasting on your podcast as well. And I want to let people know on your podcast that I'm doing a little bit of this craziness because we are doing my radio show. So so I don't want them to listen up. Why is he screaming and acting so crazy? But when it comes to social media, I've watched a lot of artists die. Because they're so connected to this that they'll read their comments and then they won't be able to sort of dig out, and they begin to try to please everyone, which goes back to what you said, that you can't please them.
Well, exactly. And furthermore, I would say artistic death is creativity by consensus.
Wow.
And if you're looking at your comments to determine Ooh. How to steer your creative ship, you're dead before you even get out of the gate.
Wow.
And that's my opinion. I think that if you look at anything that's truly groundbreaking, it went against the tide. It never would have been voted for.
Wow.
If you follow my, and I mean, I don't know why this first thing comes to mind, but like Macklemore and like, you know, thrift store like that.
Yeah.
If you had put that into the machine, that wouldn't have gotten,
spit it out.
Would never have gotten past square one.
Wow.
And some of the writing that you see that's really innovative. I just read this book called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, which is written by a really smart guy in Pakistan, actually.
Wow.
And it's written in effectively first person. So it says you wake up with the side of your head on the mud in your mother's thatched hut, and it's all you. It's just so inventive. And if he had tried that as his first book going through a traditional process,
right.
never would have worked. I don't think. It never would have seen the light of day. Yeah. So my thinking, at least, and if I look at my best work, and we've all had, well, I shouldn't say we, I'll speak for myself. I've had better work, and I've certainly had weaker work.
Right, right.
And if I look at when those things come to pass, the best work is coming from periods of deep work where I purposefully block out exterior distractions and inputs and opinions.
Right, right. Let me ask you this. When I'm on the street and people come up to me, they talk about you in a almost, not in a, in a sense of a, in an Oprah Winfrey way, but almost there's a, almost a, not to get in trouble, but you're leading. Like your people wake up and I need this Tim Ferriss. I need that. When I met Oprah Winfrey, she was an incredible light. Just like when I see you, it's an incredible light coming from you. But also too, she felt there was an incredible responsibility, because there would be times where she would be exhausted from literally carrying the 70 million downloads, you know, in a sense, metaphorical for her. Do you ever feel that way? Do you ever feel like, whoa, I didn't know that this was going to happen. So I need two parts of this. I need one, how you became that. What's the ingredient? And then two, now that you're here, do you feel a certain different responsibility?
So part one, how it happened would be, I think, first thinking of content in the way that I described. So trying to hit 10% of the people I can reach and have them love something, as opposed to trying to please everyone all the time. And then I would say the evergreen focus. Right. The piece that I didn't discuss yet that I think is important is
everyone goes after the traffic leaders. And what I mean that by that is that it could apply to magazines, it could apply to TV. They'd say, who has the greatest number of viewers, right, followers, etc.? How do I get to those influencers? Mm. And that's the most crowded channel, and it's going to be the most difficult because those are people who are in the limelight at the peak. They're the hardest to contact. What I did in the very beginning, which I think led to the tipping point for the 4-hour work week in part, is that I decided to go after the thought leaders that the traffic leaders paid attention to.
Wow.
So if you look at the people who, for instance, and this is true on, this could be true on YouTube, it could be true on, at the time, you know, this was 2007. So blogs, I was looking at blog roles and so on. I identified the thought leaders, people who were very, very smart, but weren't compulsive self-promoters. Wow. They didn't care about a large audience, but their audience was comprised of these people who had millions and tens of millions of readers. Mm. So I would do things with them.
Wow.
And wow. And the domino effect led to, over time, a very, very large broadcast capability and very large following. The in terms of the responsibility, I absolutely feel that, you know, with great audience comes great leverage and great influence to a great degree and great responsibility.
Right.
And for that reason, for instance, in the 4-hour body, there was a chapter on breath holding, which was done with David Blaine, I mentioned, and I took it out of the book because even though I had all these warnings, the audience was large enough that there were people who weren't paying attention to the warnings. And if you try to do breath holding in water, you can kill yourself with a shallow water black belt. And so I wasn't prepared at that time to accept
that.
Breaking a few eggs to make the omelet. I wasn't prepared to have metaphorical blood on my hands.
Right.
And I decided that the benefits of having it in the world were not greater than the risks and liabilities. Right. So I took it out. And I do have to be careful in a sense, because if I say something in a really offhand way, people could take it very literally. And
yeah, that's what I was going to ask you now. Now that, I mean, man, you look, my life changed in the fact of, like, people come up to me, it will blow your mind. He'll tell you. It will blow your mind of people that come up and say, it's almost, you've been blessed by him. How was he? Were you moved? Did you touch the hem of his garment? I mean, it's really on some, like, incredible admiration. So with this incredible minefield of every single thing that you say, and then the way the nature of the beast of America, of humans, we want to build him up. We say one thing, and we want to rip the cords out of his podcast. How does that work now? Or do you have the ability to go somewhere, do whatever you feel like, and no one, you know, bothers you? And, you know,
well, I think there are a few things that I try to consider to keep myself sane and also keep my head from getting too big. The first is I always assume I'm 14 minutes into my 15 minutes of fame. Wow. I just always try to assume that.
Could you tell that to some of these other people? I could just name a few right now walking around with bodyguards.
Yeah, I just assume it's never going to last forever. Of course it's not. Yeah. So there's an expiration date on it. And that's helpful, I think, number one. Well, it's very helpful for savoring the experience and not constantly looking forward to bigger and bigger plans. Right. Although that's a component, I think, of good strategy.
Right.
The second is I will very deliberately force myself, and I will schedule this in advance, to take time off the grid.
Right.
So for instance, you know, I'm going to take this July, I'm basically orchestrating, putting systems in place right now, recording things in advance so that I can go off the grid for 4 weeks.
Oh, nice.
I'm gone. And I did that before in Indonesia. No calendar, no phone. Oh. No internet, no email for 4 weeks. And it's like taking a 6 to 12 month vacation when you come back.
That feels good.
You know, you're just like, oh my God, I didn't realize, like, every notification, every email, every ping, every noise, it's just like having Chinese water torture all day. And then you turn it off and you're like, I didn't even realize I was going through Chinese water torture.
Wow.
It's an incredible relief. And it helps you with that deep work I was talking about. Helps me at least. So yes, I do very deliberately engineer my life in such a way that I can take time outside of the machine.
Wow.
Because I'm not good at I'm not good at juggling all the pieces when I'm surrounded with that noise. Right. I need time out.
It's Tim Ferriss. This is simultaneously on his podcast and Foxhole Radio Sirius 96. We're going to take a break. And as you've noticed, we are getting nourished. We're getting fed. We're going to come back and wrap up with Tim, whatever he wants to give us. To let us know how to move forward, how to get your life together, man. And yes, I have touched the hem of his garment. We back in a moment. That was an Argentinian track. What was the name of that?
That was Federico Aubele, track Esta Noche.
Esta Noche. That's amazing.
He is from Buenos Aires.
Buenos Aires. Now, you've been to these places.
I have. I got, when I did my walkabout to try to figure out my life in 2004,
yeah.
I got to Panama, and a friend of mine said, you should go to Argentina because you can live like a king for pennies on the dollar.
Really?
And the most beautiful women, most delicious steak and wine on the planet. And I was like, all right, I'll check it out.
I must go. Let's book the trip.
It was supposed to be a 4-week trip, and I was there for 9 months.
Really?
I was.
No, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Come on, Tim, now. You went there for a week, and you ended up 9 months? What was it? Was it a love? What was going on?
I was got bitten by the bug that was tango. And I had deliberately beforehand said I was not going to practice tango because the only version of tango I'd seen was like Al Pacino in Son of a Woman or Arnold Schwarzenegger in True Lies. I was like, I don't want to do that. That's not for me.
Yeah.
And ended up just becoming obsessed with it. And I went to the world championship 6 months later.
Are you serious?
I was a semifinalist, yeah.
What is going on, Tim? Break that down to us now. We were talking about podcasts, but all of a sudden you're the tango champion in Argentina. The white man goes to Argentina and shuts it down.
Well,
so you go from Japan.
Yeah.
You get a chance to take a bath with grandma first. You move up the bath food chain. Then you step into Argentina, a little wine, a little steak, and all of a sudden...
All of a sudden, I'm dancing 6 to 8 hours a day. Yeah, it was
incredible. Is it?
It was an amazing experience, and I had a fantastic dance partner. But it's all related to what we've been talking about. So the same way that I've looked at the testing of assumptions, the asking questions, so the things that I learned in Japan, just like some of the things your grandmother armed you with,
exactly.
That all added up later.
Yeah,
this ability to test assumptions. I remember in Argentina, I became infatuated with tango. And I started asking myself, what are the rules that everyone says I should do? Yeah. What if I did the opposite?
Wow.
So they say you should learn how to lead. I said, what if I learn the female part first? That's a weird step.
Wow.
So I learned the follow first from a world-class female teacher. Then I looked at competition footage and what people were teaching. And I said, all right, what's actually winning the championships and what are they teaching? And where are the gaps? What are the things that are winning championships, like long steps, certain types of pivots that aren't being taught? If I learn those, I will have an unfair advantage. So let me find the teachers who specialize in those.
So Tim, this is what I gotta ask. Where does that come from? Where does that type of thinking, I think for listeners who are listening on both your podcast and on my radio show, is that a blessed thing? Did you learn how to do that? I need two parts of this. One, is that a blessing? And two, what is a podcast?
I think it's both something it is a blessing in the sense that I've always liked asking questions.
Are you a spiritual person? Is there any?
I would consider myself, and I mean, I grapple with that word a little bit. I'm not religious. Right. I wouldn't consider myself religious, but I've had a lot of experiences in the last few years that would lead me to believe there's something out there.
What do you think it is?
That we haven't, oh boy.
Do you think we get to heaven and it's just like a gang of bathtubs that we could bathe in and it is Argentinian women? Because I used to think that heaven was going to be like just my best looking girl just in everything I see.
Right.
Like everything I saw was the epitome of what I thought beauty was.
Yeah.
And then my favorite food, which was Sonic Burger. So I get to heaven, it's just Sonic Burger.
Hot women and Sonic Burger.
Just the woman I dig, and you'd be surprised. You know, it's just like, I'm just up there eating Sonic Burger. I've got my wings, got ketchup on and all kinds of crazy things. But what do you, for a person who says, I'm not necessarily spiritual, mm-hmm. I get that, but there's a lot of things that one would say in looking at you is spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
When you see the following and what you do to a person's psyche, what you do to a person's heart and mind is a spiritual thing. So what do you think is out there? Without getting too deep. We don't have to get too deep.
Yeah, we could get into crazy town pretty quickly, but I've had some very profound experiences. I'll just go out there. So
yeah.
I've had some very
unusual experiences, primarily related to use of psychedelics.
Wow.
That in group environments, with proper supervision, that, and this is part of the reason that I'm actually helping to finance studies at Johns Hopkins,
right,
and most likely UCSF and a couple of research institutions looking, right, at medical applications of these, right, things, that have led me to believe that putting death aside and what happens after death, if anything,
right,
like maybe it's lights out and we're worm food, or,
right,
maybe there's more.
Right.
But I think right now there are potentially, well, there are a few things. We could be living in a virtual reality.
Mm.
I think there's a non-trivial chance, possibility that that's the case. And second is that maybe that's not a bad thing. Third, I think there are sort of parallel existences.
Mm.
And you might call them universes.
The bizarro of it all.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. So I do think that it's possible. And this will probably be explained by the scientific method or through experiments at some point. But right now, I can't explain a lot of what I've seen and experienced firsthand with some of these plant medicines. So that has called into question.
I love how he calls it plant medicine.
Plant medicine. It's called it.
Elijah has just experienced some plant medicines, yeah, as he's walked in. You can tell the way he's. You tell the way he's chewing that gum. There was some plant medicines going on the 101, and then pretty soon he'll disappear in a few minutes and experience some more plant medicines and come back with a big smile on his face and the answers to it all.
And so I've always asked questions, but the writing and the meeting of mentors like Buxton has taught me how to ask better questions. And so I am constantly in search of better questions because people think they need the answers. They don't need the answers. You need the right questions. And the podcast for me, so the Tim Ferriss Show was an opportunity to take a break from writing, right, and to get better at asking questions. Wow. Because if you think about what thinking is, it's a little meta, but thinking, if you reflect on your internal dialogue, is asking and answering questions in your own head.
Wow.
So if you get better at asking other people questions, you get better at asking yourself questions.
Wow.
And that improves everything. So the Tim Ferriss Show is really an opportunity for me to try to deconstruct world-class performers like yourself,
wow,
like General Stanley McChrystal, wow, like chess prodigy Josh Waitzkin,
wow,
Laird Hambledon, you know, undisputed, yeah, king of, yeah, big wave surfing, because I want to try to find the commonalities. What, yeah, do these people have in common? So at least 80% of them have a daily meditation practice, for instance, just as one example. And what are the differences?
Right.
So if I find somebody who's a morning person, wakes up at 5 to write, and then I meet someone who writes from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m.,
mm,
I want to talk about that and why that's different.
Right.
And it's been an opportunity for me to hopefully, you know, I have these conversations that are so fun. I mean, with people like yourself,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
and others. And I just thought for years, I'm like, God, it'd be so much fun and useful to share this with my,
right,
fans.
Wow.
But there was never a recorder around.
Wow.
And so,
wow,
I started the podcast. And the side gig turned into more than a side gig.
Man, when I tell you, it's amazing. So here's the question that everybody's asking now. What does Tim Ferriss do? What does Tim Ferriss do in the morning? What does Tim Ferriss do? See, this is the thing. Like the gurus and the people that have this, I call it the blessing. I call it the, you know, because I'm a spiritual person. You know, like my daughter tell you, you know, she knows the books of the Bible and everything like that. But when you see someone who has that shine, that unexplicable way to be, you're saying something that anyone else could say, but the way you're saying it, the way you're delivering it, and it works. So what do you do? How or do you listen to all of these things and sort of enhance your own routine? What do you do when you wake up in the morning? You wake up and say, man, I'm Tim Ferriss, bad motherfucker.
Sometimes I wake up, I just want to pull the sheets over my head and stay in bed. I think we all have those mornings.
Yeah, cool.
But generally, yes, I do borrow from everybody.
Yeah.
And my routine right now is I wake up. I tend to wake up on the late side because I go to bed late.
Yeah.
So I wake up, let's just say 9 o'clock will be on the later side for me. But if I'm on deadline, I'll write until 5 in the morning.
Wow.
I'll wake up in the,
wow,
afternoon. Right now, I'll wake up. I will go upstairs. I will have supplements that are better absorbed on an empty stomach. I will then feed my dog, sit down, meditate for 20 minutes.
Wow.
So that's transcendental meditation, but I also could use Vipassana or anything else. There are many different ways to go about it. Then I will, at this moment,
have specific type of tea. I usually have pu'er tea, which is a Chinese tea, mm-hmm. with turmeric and ginger, plus something called MCT oil, which helps your brain quite a bit because it gives you something you convert into ketones. Then I do acro yoga practice. So I have...
What is that?
So acro yoga is kind of like a Cirque du Soleil strength performance, typically with a man and a woman. It's actually very similar to tango, but it's gymnastics. So I'd be supporting a woman on my feet or one foot and my hands, and they'd be doing cartwheels and forward spins and headstands and shoulder stands and handstands on my hands. It's extremely fun and very good physical training.
This is every day?
I do it three times a week. So you
spin a girl on your feet?
Three times a week just, for an hour and a half
at a
time.
That's what I need to do. I need to go find me a little lightweight babe to just... flip her up around.
Yeah, you want to start with what they would call a tiny. That's a little one.
Oh, this is amazing.
And a flyer.
Right now, for my radio people, Ricardo is showing me what this is. This is amazing. What is it called now?
Acro yoga.
So you guys out there listening, go to acroyoga.com.
Acro yoga. If you just search acro yoga, there's a guy named Jason Niemer, who's the co-founder, N-E-M-E-R.
And what does this do? But does that give you some sort of interaction with female energy, or is it?
It does quite a few things for me. So what I realized for myself is that in a culture such as our own in the U.S., where we have very puritanical inclinations and baggage, there's not a lot of physical touch. It's very forbidden, right. And you have to be very, very careful about physical touch. But we are higher primates. We need physical contact. It is part of our hardwiring DNA. And acro yoga is a fantastic way to have sensual contact that is not necessarily sexual, if that makes sense.
Right.
And that gives you, I think, a charge and a therapy that is extremely valuable and hard to produce any other way. It's also very playful, and I think it's easy, for me at least, to take life too seriously, or take myself too seriously. Right. And when you're doing acro yoga, half the time you're making mistakes and falling on each other and flipping over. It's just playful. It's like going back to the playground. And I think as adults, it's very easy to think that serious is, meaning being serious, not the radio, is the tone you have to carry to do big things. Whereas I think that if you're always serious, you will end up being too exhausted to complete the truly important work.
Right.
So you have to use play as a way to rest and reset.
Now, do I use the girl I'm dating?
Sure.
For this, or do I just go?
You can do both.
Could I tell my girl, hey, I gotta? I'm gonna be in the room flipping this girl upside down. I'll be out in about an hour.
You could try that. Depends on the girlfriend.
I'll go get
this. But you are in the epicenter right here. Best acro yoga, or most of the best acro yoga instructors on the planet, are near Venice and Santa Monica.
Wow.
So you're right in the hotbed for this.
Well, I'm gonna get into that. And then what else? How do you just like, you love to tango, you love to travel, but what makes you eager? Like, I can't wait for that day. What's that makes you, because we got our jobs, we do what I think, you're leading the people, but what makes you go like, I look forward
to cheat day. So cheat day. It's the cheat day. And she's seen cheat day. So
what's the cheat day?
So I follow a diet that was in the 4-hour body. It's called the slow carb diet, and it's very manageable. You can go out to eat with people; they won't even notice you're on a restrictive diet, and it really helps with losing fat loss very quickly and building muscle. So there have been many, many cases. I mean, dozens now. People have lost 100, 150, 200 pounds, but it's also very effective for just staying lean. And the component that I think is most important, perhaps, or one of the more crucial, is the concept of cheat day. And that means you have 6 days of compliance, and then you have one day when you can do whatever you want.
Oh, man.
And I generally recommend that's a Saturday, and a lot of fans have nicknamed that Fatter Day.
Fatter Day!
And they'll send me photos of all the crap they're eating.
I want to do this.
Oh, ice cream, pizza. I mean, like yesterday, effectively was my cheat day. I was fasting for 2 days, and I was like, you know what? This doesn't feel right. And I was about, the clock struck midnight, and I was like, okay, it's cheat day. And I just demolished the entire hotel tray of goodies. And it was glorious.
Oh, yeah.
Macadamia nuts covered in chocolate.
Oh,
gummy bears.
Yes.
Candied ginger. And I didn't feel any guilt, because that's the purpose of cheat day. That's like the psychological release valve, so that
you make yourself so sick. You're like, I cannot wait to get back to my lentils and beans and chicken because right. I feel terrible.
Wow.
And then you can stick with it. And that's how people lose 100, 200 pounds.
Well, that's fantastic. Last but not least, for our listeners, we've talked about so many different things. Long Island, lung collapse, heat stroke vulnerable, college, doing it your own way. Just give us a wrap up of and I know it's sort of old school, but just it's sort of telling them, taking that person from where they are right now, because a lot of people, when they listen in, they got all kinds of people say, Fox, man, I was having a bad day. Just give them a little something, man. Just a little something from, you know, to get them going.
I would say that you do big things by starting with the small things. Right. And the way that I view my life, people ask me, like, what's your 5-year plan, 10-year plan? I don't have one.
Wow.
Because a reliable 5-10 year plan is going to be shooting below your capability. Wow. I mean, I think that if you build a really tremendous life for yourself, in retrospect, it's going to look very accidental in many respects. And to that end, I try to view my life as 2-week experiments.
Right.
And by doing that, I'm going to try X for 2 weeks. It's not a permanent decision. You can do anything for 2 weeks. Yeah. I'm going to try the slow carb diet for 2 weeks. I'm going to try fill in the blank, you know, meditating for 2 weeks. Yeah. I'm going to try whatever it might be. And you start to develop a confidence in your ability to act and change your reality for you and your family or those you care about. And people will often ask me, like, how do I get confidence? How do I get confidence? Because then I want to go out and do things. I'm like, no, you got it reversed. Mm. You have to do things small, a little bit bigger, medium-sized, and large to build that confidence. So like the only cure for lack of confidence is acting. And the way that I find easiest is to treat your life as a series of 2-week experiments.
Wow.
And it's whatever your weakness is, whatever your excuse might be. And we've all had excuses. I've had excuses. And it's like, whether it's I'm too old, I'm too young, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm too this, I'm too that, whatever it is. Yeah. There is someone who has felt that exact same way, said the same thing to themselves, and overcome it.
Wow.
And you can find those people. So go out and search for them.
Wow.
And one of the questions I ask experts all the time is, like, if I'm looking at someone who's, say, an ultra endurance runner, you know, I'll ask them, like, who is good at this, who shouldn't be, right? Like, I know that you have the people who are built like spiders, who are sort of blessed with a certain physique that makes it easier for them to do this. But I want to know, like, where's the 250-pound guy who runs 50, 100-mile races? Like, is there such a person? And they'll be like, oh, yeah, there is this one guy.
Wow.
I'll be like, okay, I want to study him.
Wow, man.
And
it's very superhero. It's very comic book superhero the way you think.
It is.
That and one, that soul.
It is. But it's a toolkit. And I do write about this toolkit a lot in the 4-Hour Chef, the last book, which is kind of a book on accelerated learning disguised as a cookbook. But it is a toolkit that anyone can use. If you have Google and you speak English, like, you are in the 1%. Like, I have to tell you, like, you have at your fingertips everything. And you just have to ask the right questions.
Wow. That's it. Fox Soul Radio, Series 96. Hey, listen, everybody out there listening, you got 2 weeks. I'll see you in 2 weeks, and you better have it done. We are with the one, the only, I kid when I first came on and said, Oprah Winfrey was a white man, but let me tell you something, Tim, you're your own man.
Thanks.
And for what you did, what you're doing for everybody, for those 70 million downloads and for those people that are in the street that you don't even get a chance to see like I see, they counting on you, brother, man. Keep doing your thing and keep giving it to us. It's Jamie Foxx, Tim Ferriss, Fox Soul Radio, Series 96. Let me tell you something. When I die, heaven better be off the chain because I'm having a ball right now. Sirius, XM 96. We going out of here. Tim Ferriss, I've touched the hem of the garment.
Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is 5 Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And 5 Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it.